Accession number 19864, Reel 3.
Georges Le Poitevin, Reel 3. You said that your companion said he would swim.
Yes, he said, well, look, I am a better swimmer than you are, and I'll go and get the boat. So I thought, well, that may be good, because that may help him to come back to his senses, you see, make him a bit sober. So I let him go, and then I think it was one of the worst times of my life. For a long time, I didn't hear anything. I saw the current had taken him, and he was drowning. And the other one that had left, the chap that had left at the station, I called them all sorts of names when I left. And they would have said, well, it drowned him because he didn't want to follow him at the last moment. So I was really, really afraid for a long time until I heard him coming back. And when he came back alongside, I make the boat secure and took him in my arm with a blanket and, you know, rubbed him, you know, he was cold, you know, anyway, we embarked, two of us, and I pushed the boat away from the bank.
What kind of boat was it?
It was a little boat of an Arab, you know, maybe 7 foot long, 7-8 foot long, with a pair of oars. Now, I realized that the oars were all broken oars, made good with a bit of wire, you see. So I said to Guy, I said, we are not going to go through the bar with des avirons comme ça. We got to find a better pair of oars. So we grabbed the boat as the tide was pulling us towards the sea and took another pair of oars on board. And I said, I asked Guy, I said, now, are you sure you want to come? We got no chance once we let go of that. So he said, yeah, we're going. So we went. And we rowed and rowed. We had to make sure that we were right in front of the bar every time, not to go sideways, otherwise we would have been rolled over and it would have been the end. So we managed to go across the bar and pull as much as we can away from the shore. And for over three nights, we rowed, you see. We used the oars. And we were, on the fourth morning, we were in front of Gibraltar. And we were so tired, you know, that we'd lost almost consciousness down the bottom of the boat. You know, we couldn't stretch our fingers, our legs, we couldn't move our legs, you know, everything was, you know, rigid. And we heard some noise, and we were taken prisoners by a Spanish ship who took us to Gibraltar, and we were in view of the rock. There we rode all that distance and all that, and we were taken, just as we were getting there, taken prisoners by that Spanish ship.
A Spanish warship?
Or a Spanish warship, a patroller, patrol and patrol, took us to Tangiers. And then, first I thought we were Americans, our boat had been sunk, you see, so you know, we both of us knew a couple of words of English, you know, so say, yes. And eventually they had an interpreter, an English interpreter, come. And then we had to say, well, no, we were not Americans. We were French sailors who wanted to reach Gibraltar, you see. But we were lucky in a way that at the time the Spanish knew that things were changing. You know, the fortunes of war were changing. If it had been 4 or 5 months before, they would have taken us back to the frontier, Moroccan frontier, you see. And then, so they put us somewhere where we were under surveillance all the time, résidence surveillée, and we signed the documents by which, after a long interrogation, you know, they did interrogate us for quite a long time, we signed that document saying that we would not leave Tangiers without their permission. So we were offered to go to the French consulate or top of the town or the British consulate, which was practically opposite the French consulate. So we went to the British consulate where we met a Mr. Green, And we had to explain, you know, I had to explain because my friend hadn't been, he'd been in the army for a long time. He stayed with the army. He had no other activities before, you see. So I had to explain what had happened to me before I decided to go. So they probably took some information back in Morocco, you know, with the resistance people there. And then they sent somebody where we were on the residence surveillée and said, well, look, we are going to help you. Be ready at any time when somebody will come and ask you to follow them. So it did happen maybe a few days after. Yes, a few days later, somebody came and made a signal, and we followed them at a certain distance, and they took us down to the beach, where a boat, a small motorboat, took us to Gibraltar. We reached Gibraltar safely.
So this was with permission of the Spanish authorities?
No. It was a clandestine departure. You know, we signed an agreement with them, but we failed to honor that agreement. We went to Gibraltar without informing them. We reached Gibraltar, and there was a mission française at Gibraltar, and we were housed there for a while. When a captain of a merchant ship came to the mission française at Gibraltar and asked for a volunteer to go on his boat to bring him his food, because his maid d'hôtel had fallen ill. So we all wanted to go, of course, to England. So we drew lots, and it happened to fall on me, you see. So I said cheerio to my friend, Giralsk, which had come with me from Rabat. And I went on that merchant ship called the Château Roux. And during the journey to England, we were attacked by submarines. We lost many ships in the convoy. We eventually were in the Gulf of Biscay. We were attacked by the German Air Force. And we took a bomb on board, which fell maybe 5-6 yards from me and didn't explode. It laid on iron ore, the ship was carried, and the boat went to Milford Haven, where an artificer came and defused the bomb, and we resume our journey to reach eventually Liverpool. When we arrived at Liverpool, I thought, had a big sigh of relief. Now I said, well, that's the end of my trouble. So I took a few things I had with me, went down the ashore, and I was stopped there by the police and said, go back on board. So I went back on board, and an hour or so later, two gentlemen came and put handcuffs on. I said, well, it's starting all over again. See, they put handcuffs on me and took me to the train, and I didn't know, understand enough English to know what they wanted, of me. You see, so they took. It lasted a few hours. The journey lasted a few hours. I think we went to a place in London called Patriotic School, where I stayed there for a couple of, maybe 10 to 15 days.
What was this patriotic school?
Well, it was where they were interrogating all the people that were arriving in this country. And of course, at the time, well, I didn't know what it meant, but I realized now that it was necessary that, you know, so... they would interrogate you, you know, at all time of day or night, even. When you were asleep, they would wake you up and ask a few questions, you see, with a light in your face, and the interrogating officer was asking you questions, you see. There was no harshness or anything in his voice, and all. He was just asking plain questions, you see, like, well, you went to the école... the maternelle in Valognes, you know, well, what was there on the square in front? Well, there was a crucifix. Oh, yes, there was a crucifix. Well, which side was facing the crucifix? Yes, okay. Now, you live in that house? No, at the top of the hill, there was a farm. Whose farm was it? Oh, it was the farm of Monsieur Hubert. Oh, yes, yes, yes. And there was a little lane by the farm. Now, the first field on that farm, there was a gate. Which side was the gate opening? And which side was the gate hung? All sorts of questions, you know, for about 10 to 15 days, you know, until they were satisfied that your answers were correct. And they were happy with what you said you were. And after that, it was okay.
So were these Frenchmen who knew the correct answers? Who were asking you the question?
They were British interrogation officers. They were MI5, you know. They were MI5. And they caught a few spies there. They were shot even at patriotic school, you see. So they, you know, they had a job to do. And you know, they did their job very well, you see. If it was during the night, I said, okay, now you can go back to sleep and all, you see. So it was done in a nice way, you see. You know, they didn't find you guilty before you had to explain what you had done and what you were doing and what you wanted to do, you see. No, they were pretty good.
Where was this patriotic school?
Well, it was somewhere in... I've had some documents lately. Somebody gave me some documents. It's outside London. It was a school before that, young lady school, you know. I don't know if it was in Wimbledon or somewhere around Wimbledon way, you know. I've had some information I could probably find.
Well, don't worry, that will be on the record. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, when it was all over and all, they gave me £50. And that's a sum I never had in my hand before. And then they took me to... the centre d'accueil in Earl's Court in London, where I was among French people then, you see, and wanting to join General de Gaulle. So, being a Navy man and all, I spent a couple of days there in the centre d'accueil. And then while I was there...
What happened to you at the centre d'accueil?
Well, I was just there to have a breather, really, you know, for people to relax a bit and sort myself out, you know. It was a centre d'accueil for that purpose, you know, for people just arriving and, you know, I were a bit traumatized by what they'd been through and all that. So I heard while I was there about being a wireless separator, I wanted to go to France, you see, straight away. But it wasn't that easy. So I heard about Maurice Buckmaster. So I managed to get an interview from with Maurice Buckmaster, and he explained my story roughly, you know, in a few words, and what happened, what I wanted to do. He said, well, we want people like you, and we'll be happy to call on you, but our course has just started, so we don't need you straight away. We will call you when the next course starts, you see.
How had you heard about Buckmaster?
Well, talking because they had some Frenchmen serving already under the, you know, the British, you know, the SOE and whatever they were, you see. So I went back to the centre d'accueil, and then I was transferred, a couple of days later, I was transferred to Clapham Common when they had a depot. The Navy had a depot there in Clapham Common. And after a few days, a wireless operator, oh no, they sent me to Skegness. I think it was called HMS Royal Arthur in Skegness for a wireless course, you know, to learn the procedure, to learn the British procedure. So I went to HMS Royal Arthur. And then I was sent to, after that course, I went to another course in Eastbourne, where we had a special course for wireless operators at Beachy Head, in a hut at Beachy Head, where we learned the German codes, you know, for the submarine, for the German submarine, because I wanted to be an HFDF, high frequency direction finder. You see, so I passed that that course in Eastbourne. Then I was hoping to have a call from Maurice Buckmaster, but as I was waiting, the French wanted the wireless operator on the submarine in Dundee, the sous-marin Junon. So I was sent to Dundee as a wireless operator to on the submarine Junon. But the submarine Junon had, was in a harbour for repairs. So all I had to do was to go and paint the ballast, I don't know what you call that, where they put all all the air and the water, you know, when the submarine sank, I don't know what the word in English, but I had to paint that with aluminium, and my state of health was already very, very poor, you know. So they realized that it wasn't good enough for me. They sent me to a surface ship, to a frigate, after 3 months. To Newcastle, where the British had built a frigate for the Free French.
What was the name of the frigate?
La Surprise. They built a few frigates. There was the Surprise, La Découverte, La Renoncule. There was a few frigates built by the British. So anyway, I embarked on that frigate, and we went around Scotland and round to the Isle of Mull, Tobermory, for trial, and we passed trial successfully, and we were assigned to the channel, you know, patrol in the channel and all that. And
had D-Day started?
No, it was it was the end of 1943, you see, from middle to end of 1943. See. And then eventually, just before D-Day, we'd been on the Atlantic approaches, you know, to get a convoy, you see, and escorted it to Plymouth and all the various harbors on the south coast. And we finished our operation on the Solent. And that particular day, we were all ready to go ashore, you know, all dressed, you know, the body you could get out, you see, was ready to go ashore when the captain called us on the deck and said, well, nobody's going out tonight. I've got an order. It's for tonight. So, well, he meant it was a D-Day for tonight. So nobody believed him, you see. We thought it was another exercise, you know, on one of the beaches, you know, and like we had before, and nobody believed him, so we went back to our own jobs, and an hour after he called us again, and probably, I don't know if he'd had more information, but he said, I give you my word of honor, that as far as I know, it's for tonight. And he gave us a double of wine and all that, you know, so I said, oh, we thought there must be something in it, you see. So you are when there was a lot of activity in the Solent, and about half past 11 midnight, we all left, hundreds and hundreds of ships left the Solent towards the coast, and the planes were flying all over, hundreds and hundreds of planes. It was incredible. And then early hours in the morning, we reached the coast, and of course, you know, the British soldiers and the infantry were landing, and the Americans and all that, they all were landing on the Normandy beaches. Of course, we stayed away from the coast. Our job was to escort the ships and all that, and to defend the ships. But we didn't land, you know, so we saw French soil, you know, from a very short distance. But so that was the day.
And you were the wireless operator
in
the ship?
Yeah, I was the wireless. Yes, I was. I've been promoted. I was quartier mate in those days. Yeah. Oh, yes.
Was the ship attacked during the Normandy operation?
No, we saw a couple of German planes flew over the Armada, but no, we were not attacked at all. But we went back for another convoy, and eventually, when we were in front of Port Ambessin, our ship was blown up on a magnetic mine, you see. So we lost our propellers. The ship so almost sunk, but resurfaced, you know, went back on top, and we took some water, of course, but the ship being built with rivets, you know, a good ship, the rivets moved, but if it had been an American soldered ship, we would have broken in half, but it's the ship survived, and for a couple of days we were off, the tugs were taken off the coast until one could take us for repairs to a proper harbor.
When the La Surprise was blown up, what were you doing?
Well, I was in a boiler room. And then some people, I don't remember who they were there, they squeezed through through the transmitter and all that, you know, little gap that not even a little boy could have squeezed through. They managed to squeeze through and to get out of the wireless room. A loudspeaker fell on my head and almost knocked me down. It's probably why I didn't move from the seat where I was. Anyway, the ship resurfaced, you know, and we didn't sink. You know, American ship were coming to us, wanting to evacuate the crew, but nobody was evacuated. We stayed on the ship, and eventually we were towed up to Pembroke Dock again. See, the first time when I came to this country, my ship had an unexploded bomb on board, where I went to Milford Haven. This time, my ship was in that area for repairs. And it is destiny. It's where I met my wife, eventually.
Yeah. Your wife is from Pembrokeshire?
From Pembroke, where I met her when my ship was on repairs there.
How did you meet your wife?
Well, I went ashore, and of course there was that Lanyon Barrack, a place where the soldiers and all the armies, Americans, there were all sorts of nationalities there, where they used to go and dance in the evening, and it's how I met her, you see, and well, she was much younger than I. She was just over 16 in those days. So, but we became good friends and all that, and I kept in touch with her all the time after, you see. Then, when the ship was repaired, we went back to Portsmouth.
Did you visit her parents' house?
Oh yes, but you know. A young girl to go with a French sailor was not recommended, really, you know. So I used to send her a telegram, you see, to meet you at such a church, you know. So the parents, when they had the telegram, they were afraid that it was something really, you know, nasty arriving. So anyway, I met her a few times. I eventually met her parents and all. I met them a few years after, but then they were very, very good. They were fantastic parents. They were fantastic in-laws to me. After repairs, the boat went back to Portsmouth. But then I thought I'd reached the end of the line, you see. The D-Day had been over to me. I'd achieved what I wanted to achieve. And I was seriously ill by then. I was sweating. And
what did you have?
Tuberculosis. Advanced tuberculosis.
How had you got that?
Well,
from the prison?
For the prison, the jail, the treatment, you see, for all those months in jail. But so I was disembarked there at Portsmouth, and they took me to Hassler Hospital, where I was examined and. And then eventually I was taken to a sanatorium in Beaconsfield, where the French had a sanatorium there during the war, and it was a fantastic place. The doctors and the nurses were incredible.
Were they French staff?
No, well, the doctors were, but the nurses were British, so lots of them were British. from the Red Cross. Some of them were helping around, you know, and they were incredibly nice to us, you know. We had anything we wanted to eat, we had, see. And, of course, in those days, there was no antibiotics, no penicillin, and it was almost a certain death. And I saw many of my comrades go. We had a small cemetery just in the center of Beaconsfield, by the church there, and lots of them were buried there, and of course they were moved after the war to Brookwood Military Cemetery, where there are some of them are still there now. Some of them have been taken back to France by their family. But there was no hope when you got into that sanatorium that you would come out alive, you know. There was no hope at all.
So did you make a full recovery from the TB?
Well, it took many years, you know. First, I had what they call an artificial pneumothorax, where I was sent to Harefield Hospital for that particular operation. And then I kept that artificial pneumothorax for 9 years. See, and while it took me just over 9 years to regain the strength and you know, the physical ability to start work again, you see.
Were you able during this time to keep contact with your fiance?
Oh, she wrote to me every day. Yes.
Were you able to keep contact with your home in Normandy?
Oh, no.
Did you know what had happened?
No, I didn't. I didn't have any contact with the family for over 5 years.
How did you find out what had happened to them?
Well, when I returned after the war, you see, I stayed. The French gave me permission. And then my wife's now family asked me to come and stay with them for a month. I stayed with them for a month, and then eventually I was repatriated to France. You see, at the end of September 1945, I was repatriated to France.
What had happened to your family in Normandy during the war?
Well, that part of Normandy, the German hadn't been too nasty with them, you see. They suffered more with the American bombing than they did with the German in that part of France, you know, in Normandy. My town, Valognes, was completely devastated. We had a fantastic, beautiful church there in Valognes, and it wasn't repaired after the war because it was damaged to an extent where the repairs were not, you know, were not possible. But they didn't suffer too much. Of course, they had deprivation, but they were in the country. You know, they had eggs, butter, and milk, and they didn't suffer too much in that area of France, you see.
How do you spell Valognes?
V-A-L-O-G-N-E-S. Valognes. It's on a road from to Cherbourg, National 13.
So, what happened after Beaconsfield?
Well, after Beaconsfield, we were repatriated to France on a Red Cross ship to Brest, and then eventually I was demobbed then and sent back to my family. I didn't know if I still had family or not. You know, I had no idea.